Campus FM presents a talk organized by the Malta Classics Association entitled Music and Emotion in Ancient Greece and China. This talk is delivered by Professor David Cooper.
It's a pleasure to see you all here.
Despite the success that the Greco-Latin forma mentis has had in the world and its development, the 21st century is ushering a sort of new sense which touches us Maltese rather specially, because we are being asked to sort of jump outside the pond of the Mediterranean Sea and reach out to others, particularly other cultures. So it is a particular pleasure for me this evening to introduce this talk from Professor Cooper, who incidentally wrote quite an exciting book about world religions and world philosophies, actually. That's what the book is called, besides all the other books that he has written, and where we are going to explore the relationship between emotion and music. Of course, this relationship is not new to us Maltese. In Maltese, the word for feeling and the word for sound are the same word, actually, so it's nothing new to our mentality. But Professor Cooper is going to discuss Plato's ideas about these things and the Chinese philosophers' ideas about these things. So I think now we should let him take over, and thank you.
Thank you very much, Michael, for the introduction, and thanks very much to the Malta Classics Association for inviting me to give this talk. I've been into the it's a very impressive website of the association, and it's very good to see classics flourishing so much in Malta. I think a lot of classicists in the UK would be very jealous indeed. I think if on a really warm summer's evening I was giving a talk about music in ancient Greece and China in the northeast of England, I think I'd have an audience of about three, not any. this talk has its origins, actually. It descends from a paper I did at a quite interesting conference about 3 years ago at the Oxford Centre for Chinese Studies, and it was a comparative philosophy conference comparing ancient Greek and ancient Chinese philosophical views. And on each theme belonging to the conference, a British scholar, a philosopher or a classicist, was paired off with a Chinese scholar, both talking about roughly the same sort of thing. And so I and a Chinese scholar were talking about aesthetics, and between us we decided that the topic of music might be a fruitful one for sort of comparisons between ancient Chinese and ancient Greek views. Well, by way of a sort of preamble, let me draw some attention to some of the similarities and affinities between debates about music in Greece and China between roughly the 5th century and the 2nd century BC. And perhaps the first similarity is simply this, that in both cultures there was very lively debate about music. For example, debates about music's relationship to the wider cosmos. Pythagoras and Plato speak of the music of the spheres, the idea being that the motions of the planets are in a harmony that replicates relations between musical pitches. In the Chinese Book of Rites, the Li Ji, music is described as sort of encapsulating the harmony of heaven and earth. more relevant to my theme tonight, were debates about music's role in the cultivation of virtue and in moral and political education. I mean, these were turbulent times in both civilizations, times which made an emphasis on the cultivation of the virtues and on political education very urgent. This was the period of the warring states in China, of the Persian, Peloponnesian, Macedonian, etc. wars in Greece. In both civilizations, music is taken very seriously. In both cultures, there's quite an extensive literature on music, some of which I'll be referring to. The importance of music is attested to in myths. The myth of Orpheus, for example, in Greece, where Orpheus's singing and playing has the power to influence nature. Pindar, in his ode, speaks of the divine Apollonian origins of music. And in China, the legendary Yellow Emperor is said to have achieved his union with nature through the playing of music in natural environments. In both civilizations, music has a significant place in the curriculum, in the education of young men. And in both societies, music is regulated by the state. It's thought to be sufficiently important for the state to have some control over what's sung and played. Plato famously says that if he could control what songs could be sung in Athens, he'd leave the rest of lawmaking to somebody else. Music is taken very seriously, partly because it's credited with having a powerful force over human beings. Plato says that music is designed, or should be designed, for the improvement of the soul. And Confucius in China says that it's through music that people can perfect or complete themselves. Something I think that's very important to appreciate is that in neither culture was music regarded as perhaps we tend to regard it, as primarily in an aesthetic way, as something to listen to, as it were, for its own sake. Music's always discussed in Greece and China in an ethical, political, and educational context. It's worth noting that it's in the Republic, the laws, and the politics that Plato and Aristotle have their main discussions of music. And the most substantial Chinese essay on music by the Confucian Xunzi is essentially an essay criticizing a utilitarian political philosophy. This emphasis, as it were, pragmatic emphasis on the role of music in politics, morality, education, this, I think, reflected the actual place of musical activity in Greece and China. A historian writing in 300 AD, looking back to these times, says that no action among men was carried out without music. Hymns, feasts, assemblies, wars, marches, sailing and rowing, all of this was done, as it were, to the accompaniment of music. And it was the exception, rather than the rule, for music to be listened to and enjoyed by itself or for its own sake. Its primary role was in ritual, public ceremony, worship, and so on, and as an accompaniment to dance and poetry. I mean, poems, odes were typically recited musically. It'd be nice at this stage to sort of produce a sort of CD of sort of ancient Greek music, but actually relatively little, I think, is known about what it sounded like. It may have sounded actually perhaps rather dull to us. It was almost certainly monophonic, that is, you know, sung and played in unison without harmony, let alone counterpoint. I know the issue of what sort of ancient Greek music might have sounded like is something that the producer and choreographer of a Joe Frigieri's forthcoming play have been thinking about. I'm sure many of you will be going to his play at the Manuel Theatre early in October about the last days of Socrates, in English translation, Swan Song, and we're promised music and dancing. And I, for one, am going to be very interested in what the choreographer and producer decide upon. Okay, so I've pointed out various affinities, similarities in the debates about music in two civilizations. Are these affinities and similarities of, so to speak, merely historical scholarly interest? Well, I think not. I think they're worth attending to for additional reasons than merely scholarly ones. I think paying attention to the affinities of the debates, you know, helps us appreciate at least two matters whose importance might otherwise be missed. I mean, first, I think the seriousness with which music was taken in ancient cultures, that wasn't just a Greek idiosyncrasy or a Chinese idiosyncrasy. The fact that in both those great civilizations music was taken so seriously, I think suggests that in cultures where the moral focus is on self-cultivation and the development of the virtues, in cultures like that, music and the arts are always going to be taken seriously for their potential role in self-cultivation and moral development. I think if you looked at, as it were, the history of India, at the sort of time we're talking about, you'd find a similar importance being attached to music by Indian thinkers. A second, as we'll see in a moment, there's an important disagreement between Plato and Aristotle over the role of music, and one which has parallels with a disagreement amongst Chinese thinkers. And I think noticing those parallels, you know, suggests that, again, there's not some merely parochial disagreement between a couple of Greek thinkers or between a couple of Chinese thinkers. Rather, this is evidence of a deep and pervasive difference, one about the education of the emotions, to be found in many ancient cultures, and indeed, I suggest, going right down to the present. More of that later. Let me turn then to Plato and Aristotle. I just mentioned an important disagreement between them, but it's important to recognize that there's a lot they agreed upon as well about the nature of music and its place in society. And they agree for a start that music is, as they put it, a mimetic art or craft, techne. It's therefore to be categorized alongside poetry, the art of poetry, rather than, say, the art of carpentry or horse breeding, because poetry and music, unlike carpentry or horse breeding, are mimetic. And for both Plato and Aristotle, what music imitates or expresses are not features of the outside world, battles, storms, or whatever. What music imitates is, as Aristotle puts it, character and passions or emotions. Music imitates, says Plato, the good and evil in men's souls. And that's because music can express, or if you like, imitate, calm, anger, courage, temperance, so on and so on. And it's because of this mimetic role that music has that Plato and Aristotle also agree that music is of the first importance in moral education and civic life. And that's because, as in the case of literature, the passions which are aroused by musical imitations all too easily transfer to real life. If I could read it, I've got a quote from Aristotle, but it says roughly that listening to the sort of imitations of the passions and emotions, a person is drawn to sympathize with those emotions or passions. And it's very important, therefore, that attractive music, especially the sort of music that young people are going to be attracted by, that this should express desirable emotions and character traits, not vicious ones, otherwise it'll corrupt the young. And actually, in the literature of the time, you find lots of anecdotes, some of them extraordinarily far-fetched, about the impact of music on people's emotions. I remember in one such anecdote, there's a group of very rowdy, drunken young Athenians bent on trouble. And somebody notices the danger and tells some musician to sing and play on the lyre some very soothing, calming piece of music. And immediately all the young men calm down, go home meekly as lambs. Okay, there's a lot of agreement between Plato and Aristotle, but various differences soon emerge. For Plato, music's role is essentially, perhaps even solely, a public and civic one. Whereas for Aristotle, it's also, as he puts it, a source of intellectual culture in a person's leisure hours. Now, when Aristotle speaks about leisure, he doesn't mean one sort of idle, lotus-eating hours. He's referring to activities that are, as it were, undertaken for their own sake, not dictated by pragmatic aims, such as earning a living or getting some food. And it's in the right use of leisure, he says, that one finds the basis of a distinctively human activity. And his point being, I think, that everything that animals do, they do because they, as it were, need to. And what distinguishes human beings is an ability to, as it were, transcend their needs and to do things for their own sake, or out of pure interest. Second, for Aristotle, music is, or at any rate should be, a source of pleasure, and hence is related to the proper goal of life, eudaimonia. Whereas Plato, notoriously, is pretty suspicious of pleasure. The tendency of pleasure, he says, is to derange people. And he says that music should be no more enjoyable than it has to be in order to enhance public occasions, recitation of odes, and so on. But more crucial, I think this is the crucial difference between Plato and Aristotle, concerns how it is that music can perform its ethical and educational role. In Plato, the talk is all of training. Music can bridle and exercise young minds. And he's constantly making a comparison with gymnastics and bodily disciplines that can also help to improve and mould the character of young people. You know, a sort of cold shower followed by some discus throwing is jolly good for young chaps, and so is the right kind of music. In his dialogue, The Laws, Plato includes music amongst the strings that can be pulled in order to control people, because people, as he says, are just puppets. In Aristotle, on the other hand, the talk is instead of learning and cultivating through the mimetic arts, including music. The study of music, he says, and by the study of music, I think he doesn't mean musicology. He means sort of attentive, informed playing, singing, and listening. The study of music is a branch of learning and develops the power of forming right judgments. For Aristotle, music is enjoyable, essentially, because it's a dimension of the distinctively human enjoyment of, as he puts it, getting to understand something. And that, I think, very important difference between Plato and Aristotle leads on to a further crucial disagreement between them over music's role in education, particularly education of the emotions. Plato and some of his later admirers, like Posidonius, regard the emotions as irrational. They're therefore to be trained and shaped by means that are not themselves exercises of reason, trained, for example, by bodily disciplines, or indeed music. Plato is quite explicit that music prepares young people to greet reason like an old friend once they get older, but is not itself an engagement in reason. The Neoplatonist Plotinus said a few centuries later that what enjoys and is beguiled by music is the reasonless soul. Indeed, for the Platonists, I think, emotional life, not being rational, must be controlled by, in the sense of being subjected to, ruled by, the faculty of reason. For Aristotle, on the other hand, music, the study of music, is itself a rational activity, a branch of understanding, a form of knowledge of the passions and of character. Like the catharsis afforded by tragedy, the experience of music can confer the power of forming right judgments upon noble characters and deeds. For Aristotle, moreover, emotional life can be rational. Emotions can be appropriate to, or inappropriate to, their objects. They can be consistent with, or inconsistent with, one another, and so on. The intersection of music and emotion is not, therefore, that of two non-rational realms, but of two potentially rational orders of experience. Well, I'll come back to that and the implications for, as it were, the education of the emotions and the virtues a bit later, after taking a sort of brief detour via China. Music was an important topic in Chinese thought, at least from Confucius in roughly the 5th century BC. He himself was a lover of music and, as I noted, claimed that music has the power to complete or perfect a person. One of the six Confucian classics traditionally ascribed or attributed to Confucius was called the Yueji, the Book of Music. It was lost, so nobody knows quite what it said. And Confucius bequeathed an interest in music to some of his later disciples, particularly the 3rd century BC thinker Chun Tzu, who wrote a lengthy essay on music, which was actually a criticism of an earlier thinker called Mo Tzu. Now, Mo Tzu has been described as the first utilitarian, and a utilitarian of a pretty sort of crude sort. In the 19th century was called sort of gas and water utilitarianism, because it was Mo Tzu's view that the only criterion of value was something's contribution to material welfare. He mentions food, clothing, shelter as really the only things that matter to people. And music, since it doesn't feed anyone or clothe them or provide shelter, does very badly by Mo Tzu's utilitarian test. And in some ways, I think Mo Tzu is comparable to Plato. There's the same suspicion, perhaps even hostility, towards pleasure. Mo Tzu says rather censoriously that pleasure was not the way of the sage kings. More important, I think both of them had a pragmatic, instrumentalist view of the value of art in society. Just as in the Republic, Plato banished the poets, so Mo Tzu wanted, quote, to put a stop to this thing called music, because it brings no benefit to the common people. Now, Plato may have disagreed with Mo Tzu empirically over the possible benefits of music, but I think he agreed with him that it's only if music is of pragmatic means-end value that it should be permitted in a well-ordered state. Sun Tzu, who wrote the essay critical of the utilitarian Mo Tzu, he merits comparison, I think, with Aristotle. music, he says, provides pleasurable representations of emotions, character, and the like, and hence has a power to make good the hearts of people, to arouse the best in people's nature. Music, he says, is a joy which man cannot help but feel. Actually, that's something of a pun, because the Chinese character for music, yuei, also means joy. Music, Chunzi says, is educative. It's suited, for example, to getting people to appreciate forms and abstract structures of the kind that it's very important to have a grasp of in subjects like mathematics. Music, more generally, has a capacity to illuminate the truth and do away with what's false. And crucially, as for Aristotle, so for Shunzu, music isn't a mere means to understanding and virtue. It embodies these. The sage, through his mindful appreciation of music, is carrying out the way, the Tao. For he discerns in the best music a vivid manifestation of rational order. Good music at once manifests and requires from the player and listener controlled, rational, appropriate emotions. Okay, so of the thinkers I've mentioned, except for Mozu, who regards music as just a sort of hopeless, frivolous waste of time, all the ones I've mentioned take music and its potential for good very seriously. Music engages importantly with education, with the emotions and the virtues. But we've noticed a real division emerging about the nature of this engagement. And it's a division, I think, which stretches from classical times really down to the present. And the rest of this talk is really reflecting on that sort of division. I mean, in one corner stand Plato and his heirs, for whom music, rightly managed and engineered, has beneficial effects on people's characters, including their emotional makeup and their moral outlook. And hence music has a proper place in any training that aims at such effects. Music on this approach can, for example, relax people so that they return with renewed vigor to the serious business of life or study. It can acclimatize people to forms and abstract structures of a sort that's important for science and mathematics. It can arouse useful emotions like patriotism and courage. And making music can be a useful way for encouraging cooperation among people. It's good for sort of encouraging team playing. And so on, many other benefits. Notice that those beneficial effects of music are not, as it were, mediated by understanding or reason. The whole procedure is automatic. Play the right kind of music and people will relax and feel invigorated. It'll raise their courage before they go into battle or whatever. This is all a kind of automatic mechanism. Well, in the other corner, stand Aristotle, Aristoxenes, Chunzu, and their heirs. And they don't deny the, as it were, pragmatic benefits stressed by Plato and his admirers, but they insist that the engagement of music with education, emotion, and virtue is also a much more intimate one than simply being a useful means to certain ends. And my last few remarks are going to concern this sort of intimacy of music, emotion, education, and virtue, which I think Aristotle and others want to insist on. First, a few comments on music, education, and emotion. If education, as one modern philosopher puts it, is initiation into forms of understanding, then disciplined experience of music belongs within education. For it's in part through music that people may learn how to feel, learn what affective responses are appropriate, learn to tell when emotion is being faked or exaggerated. The appreciator of music learns how to distinguish the vulgar from the elegant, the sentimental from the authentic, the bombastic from the majestic. In music, after all, we're experiencing embodied emotion, expressions of love, pride, sadness, and so on. And in doing so, we're getting to know these emotions, to distinguish them, and judge their appropriateness to the objects which arouse them. It's true, of course, that we encounter all of these emotions in, as it were, real life. But encountering them, as it were, vicariously in music and art allows for a certain coolness, a certain distance from the emotions that allows us to reflect on them and make sense of them. We're not overwhelmed by them as we would be in real life. Think of the difference between watching Shakespeare's Othello or going to Verdi's opera Othello and actually being, in Othello's palace, realizing what's going on. One would be overwhelmed by the situation in a way which one isn't when attending the play or the opera. Aristotle, I think, would have applauded some remarks by the contemporary British philosopher Roger Scruton in his book The Aesthetics of Music, where Scruton says, for example, that musical works are icons which we appropriate in order to bring form, lucidity, and self-knowledge to our inner life. We're helped to understand life through its embodiment in music. And music doesn't simply express our emotions, it can help to form them and to provide us with a medium in which to encounter ourselves.